Slavery and Anti-Slavery. This lecture is the last in the series on the Empire and its impact on British culture, economy and society. I'd like to look at both slavery as an institution and its impact on the British economy and on the abolition movement, which grew up in the second half of the 18th century. Slavery then had been well established in the transatlantic world before Britain began to get involved. The ancient empires of Egypt, Greece and Rome had all utilised slave labour, and within Europe, both Portugal and Spain had well established slave trades by the 16th century. The reasons for England's involvement were primarily bound up with the rival ambitions amongst the Western maritime powers. As we've seen, England set up and settled colonies in the West Indies and North America from the 17th century onwards. Initially, these were scattered along the eastern seaboard of North America and throughout the Caribbean. Later, key acquisitions were Jamaica and American territories in Carolina, East and West Jersey, and Pennsylvania. The colonies then were regarded as markets for manufactured goods and raw materials for the mother country. They were characterised often by large agricultural plantations, as seen as the most cost-effective way of maximising output. But these needed a large labour force. Efforts to coerce or persuade the Native Americans to provide the workforce largely failed. White workers in the form of indentured servants offered a temporary solution, but the slave trade gave a more permanent answer. The slave trade operated on a triangular basis, with legs of the voyage stretching from British ports to West Africa, from the West African coast to the eastern shores of America and the West Indies, and from the Americas back to Britain. The trade was extensive. Between 1662 and 1807, slave exports from Africa amounted to around 3.3 million people. The slaves then mostly worked on plantations in America, producing rice and tobacco, and in the British Caribbean, mainly sugar, although some worked on coffee plantations. There were, of course, others who were involved in more general agriculture and as indentured servants. Slavery was justified on cultural, though, as well as on economic grounds. And in its essence, this was characterised by blatant racial prejudice against the black Africans. The English associated black skin with the devil and characterised the Africans as savage and ruled by lust. Slavery was justified because of its presence in the ancient world and in the scriptures, and Hobbes and Locke both accepted slavery as a normal feature of society. However, it also helped that the slaves generally resided overseas, thus English values of freedom and liberty could be upheld without trouble on English soil. The economics of the slave trade then has become known as the triangular trade. On the outward voyage from the English home ports of usually London, Bristol or Liverpool, the ships were laden with manufactured goods that could be exchanged for slaves in Africa. The second stage was known as the Middle Passage, where the slaves were taken from Africa to Americas. This leg was particularly risky. The ships were buffeted by Atlantic storms, and the crew and the slaves often became ill through disease, malnutrition or dehydration. There was also a constant threat of slave risings on board ship. The final leg of the voyage then was where the ships carried sugar, tobacco, rice and other staple products back to Britain. Altogether, the complete slaving voyages took about a year. During the peak years, the trade was carried out either by companies or by private traders. The main companies involved were the Royal African Company and the South Sea Company. The former was established by a royal charter in 1672, which gave it the monopoly right to trade with Africa for 1,000 years. However, in 1698, William III and Parliament opened up the slave trade to private merchants in an explicit attack on monopolies held by chartered trading organisations. The Africa Company attracted prominent investors, including John Locke, Sir George Carteret, who was the proprietor of South Carolina, Sir Edmund Andros, the former governor of New York, and the Bristol philanthropist Edward Colston. But in spite of its advantages, the company struggled to make profits, and by 1712 was technically bankrupt. The South Sea Company was created in 1710, explicitly to deliver contracts for slaves in British vessels to the colonies of Spanish America, including New Spain, New Granada, and Cuba. This company too found it difficult to make profits, and its credibility was severely challenged by the South Sea Bubble Crisis of 1720. The companies then fared badly, mainly because of the competition provided by private traders. Before 1700, about half the slaves delivered to the Americas came from ships owned by private merchant firms, but after this date, their share increased dramatically. Initially, ships traded from London and Bristol, but in the 1720s, Liverpool began to get involved in the trade, and by the 1740s, had overtaken the other two ports. Even in 1807, the last year of the slave trade, Liverpool sent out 101 ships, whilst Bristol and London dispatched none. Bristol had established its links with the slave trade because of its western outlook and also previous trading links in the Atlantic. The Bristol merchants concentrated on supplying slaves to Jamaica, England's largest sugar island, but lost ground to Liverpool during the war years of the 1740s when they converted many of their slave ships to privateers. Liverpool merchants did not switch to privateering, and they also benefited from being based in a more northern port, which offered safe passage, avoiding sea lanes patrolled by the French and Spanish. Liverpool merchants were more flexible than their Bristol counterparts, switching between tobacco, sugar, and slaves as the commercial opportunities presented themselves. Liverpool had a thriving shipbuilding industry, which supported the slave trade, providing a plentiful supply of vessels. And finally, it had a sophisticated credit and financial network, which enabled merchants to go on trading whilst they were waiting for their bills to be paid by the colonial planters. The costs of operating the slave trade were substantial and increased as the 18th century progressed. So, for example, Bristol slave merchants invested around £50,000 to £60,000 per annum in the 1710s. But in Liverpool, the sums were £200,000 in 1750 and over £1 million in 1800. But did they make a profit? Contemporaries certainly thought this was the case. It was once argued that British merchants made a return of 30% on the capital they invested in the slave trade. But more recent analysis has revised this figure. So, for example, between 1770 and 1792, the profits per venture of the Bristol slave trade came to 7.6%. In Liverpool, there were returns of around 8 to 10%. These are not the high profits imagined by contemporaries, but fare well with other types of investment in the 18th century. Whether the slave trade made a contribution to the economic development of Britain has been a controversial topic since the publication of Eric Williams's book, Capitalism and Slavery, in 1944. Williams argued the gains were substantial and also linked to the origins of industrial capitalism in Britain. Some historians agree with the broad thrust of Williams's arguments, arguing that the slave trade and overseas demand made a critical contribution to industrialisation. Others are sceptical of the scale of the impact of the slave trade on economic growth, and emphasise it did not make much difference at the margin. Those historians then argue that it was the demand created by the slavery sugar nexus that was a stimulus to British economic performance, as opposed to the capital investment in industry. In the period 1748 to 1775 in particular, income flowing back to Britain from increased sugar production in the Caribbean led to higher levels of exports to the West Indies. So sugar imports, sugar consumption, and sugar revenues all doubled in this period. And it's been argued that Caribbean-based demand may have accounted for 35% of the growth in total British exports. So to sum up then, the trade probably strengthened the British economy and played a significant, if not decisive, role in its evolution. Moving on to abolition then. For the first half of the 18th century, slavery was largely accepted by the majority of the educated classes in Britain, and there was no movement for abolition. These attitudes began to shift in the second half of the century, and we can see two spurs for this, both in an intellectual movement and in the religious inspired campaign. The first major landmark in the intellectual attack on slavery came from Montesquieu in 1748. He argued that the state of slavery is in its own nature bad, and argued that where slavery existed, laws should be introduced to guard against its nature. Philosophers of the Scottish Enlightenment also argued against slavery and the slave trade. Adam Ferguson's Institutes of Moral Philosophy argued that no one is born a slave because everyone is born with all his original rights. And Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments also argued that there is not a Negro from the coast of Africa who does not possess a degree of magnanimity, which is the soul of his sordid master, is too often scarce capable of receiving. William Blackstone echoed the arguments of Montesquieu in his commentaries on the laws of England, rejecting all reasons for the existence of slavery, regarding it as affront to rationality and natural law. This intellectual movement against the institution of slavery was mirrored by changes in religious attitudes. John Wesley, for example, attacked slavery as a morally evil institution. Wesley had had experience of slave plantations when he travelled to Georgia in the 1730s. The Quakers, too, were spearheading the campaign against slavery, establishing the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade in 1787. And from the 1760s, they disowned any Quaker who engaged in the trade. Evangelical Anglicans were also committed to abolition. William Wilberforce, the MP for Hull, led the campaign in Parliament, and with other members of the Clapham set, spearheaded the movement in the country. The campaign was helped by the legal decision in 1772 made by Lord Chief Justice Mansfield. Mansfield ruled that English law did not support the keeping of a slave on English soil, and thus it was very difficult for slave owners to bring their black slaves back home to England with them. The abolitionists were supported by a healthy petitioning movement from 1787. Petitions were signed by over 1.5 million people in Britain, almost a sixth of the total population. The abolitionists also established a free black colony in Sierra Leone, although this colony was plagued with recurrent problems of disease, political and financial failure. There was an outpouring of anti-slavery tracts, hymns, novels, poems and pamphlets. And members of the black community in London also publicised the movement. There were, however, important obstacles preventing the abolition of the slave trade in Parliament. The West India interest, comprising mainly of planters and merchants, was a powerful presence. Around 50 MPs were tied to the pro-slavery lobby, and supporters included George III. Eric Williams has suggested that slavery was eventually abolished for economic as opposed to moral reasons. He argued that many Caribbean sugar estates suffered from soil exhaustion, indebtedness, and overproduction. However, attacks on Williams' thesis came mainly from Seymour Drasher, an economist. He established that although there were some economic problems in the Caribbean plantations, the West Indian share of total British trade actually increased during the period that Williams had argued for decline. So if economic reasons were not the main reason for the slave trade to be abolished, why was it dismantled so quickly in 1807? The answer then lies in the changed parliamentary and international context. The new Ministry of All the Talents in 1807, which replaced Pitt's government, responded positively to Wilberforce's bill, arguing for abolition as in the national interest. The foreign slave trade effectively stopped a third of the British slave trade overnight and was followed by a general motion to abolish the slave trade on the grounds of humanity, justice, and sound policy. However, the 1807 Act did not end the campaign against slavery. Although trade in slaves had stopped, slavery was still legal in the British colonies. And the later anti-slavery campaigns are characterised in particular by the fact that they drew women into the campaign. They played a far more extensive and active role in later campaigns, forming anti-slavery ladies' associations and taking part in widespread national petitioning. The political anti-slavery movement continued to be supported by a corresponding cultural movement against slavery, consisting of poetry, tracts, literature, stories, many written by women.